Welcome to the Dividing Line. It is a Tuesday. We're going to do our best to be here during this challenging time for you this week. Try to be here as much as possible. I was honestly looking at the possibility of not being here today, but that did not pan out. And I guess that's good and bad, depending on how you look at it. Anyway, that situation might suddenly require my immediate attention. We'll see. And a little bit of travel in the process. But we are here. And for those of you just hiding out, you know, it's amazing. Everything I've read, the best place for everybody would be outside. It's March, April here in Phoenix is always a windy, well, not always windy, but that's if you're going to have wind in the spring, that's when it's going to be. Just yesterday, we had a cold front sweep by north of us, northern part of the state. We didn't get anything down here, but we had beautiful wind. Air is as clean as can be. It's in the mid 70s. It's going to be pushing 80 at the end of the next week. In the 80s, in the middle of next week. And it just seems incredibly unwise that people are cooped up together in small spaces. I just not making any sense at all. But that's what's going on. So, hey, get out and, breathe in the air. This stuff, is much more, contagious in a small controlled area without wind, than it is out in the beautiful outdoors. Yes. So that's pretty quick. I mean,
did you hear about some of the local parks around the country that waived their fees and told people get outside?
No, because all the parks around here have closed up. They've shut down the restrooms and go away.
So they, all these people go outside, and then they go, wait a minute, there's too many people in the park. Get out of here.
Yeah.
You're too close together.
Totally crazy. Anyway, that's even impacted my riding outside because I know where all the parks are. So I know where the restrooms are. You do a 100-mile ride, you got to stop a couple times, especially when you're pushing 60 years old. You got to stop a couple times and everything is closed. Me and Zwift are I'm crushing out the big numbers right now. I'm literally, before the end of the week, going to do a 100-mile ride with 5,600 feet of climbing in Zwift. So that's inside. I'll try to do it in less than 6 hours, but yeah, would rather do that outside. I'll definitely have the doors and windows open, let the air blow through. But anyway, so wherever you are, we're going to try to lift your spirits and help you out. I want to start with a friend at church posted this text. I think Sunday night after church, actually. And I happened to look at it. His name's Andrew. He's involved with the Cultish program. He and Jerry do a lot of the work on Cultish, if you've seen that webcast. And Andrew has the, outside of my granddaughters, the cutest little girl in the world named Marley. She's just a doll. And some of you may have seen the picture where Marley and I were giving the benediction a couple Sundays ago. Back when you could still get together and stuff. Anyway, and it was, you know, people share Bible verses constantly on Facebook. If you follow almost any number of Christians, you'll have Bible verses scrolling by you all day long on Facebook. But this one caught my attention, too. And obviously, it's good to give a context. Maybe the reason it catches the attention is, hey, honestly, if you are in a context, because I don't really feel like in Arizona we're in this context. We're not locked inside our houses. People are walking around and people are going out. And it's not, you know, all the big events. It's not where you're going and you're hanging out with a bunch of people. But you can go to the grocery store and you can do your thing. And like I said, the weather is absolutely positively perfect and being outside is the best possible thing for you. This particular text you know, you post it, we got to put up there, and you're looking at it, and it's like, I think one of the reasons that maybe this strikes us is most of us haven't read much of the Minor Prophets. So maybe if you are in one of those places where you can't get out like we can here, maybe you ought to make it your goal. This would be a really good goal. To read the Minor Prophets. Because I've told the story before. Remember, told a billion times before. Why did I read the Bible through for the first time? Do you remember? You don't remember. It was a Jack Chick track. It was a Jack Chick track. There's a Jack Chick track. You say it three times fast. Jack Chick track. It's very hard. It was a Jack Chick track that had a person dying, which you may not want to read. a lot of Jack Chick tracks have people dying. And he goes to heaven, and he's walking along the streets of gold, and who does he run into but Habakkuk? And Habakkuk says, "Hey, great to have you here. Hey, what did you think of my book?" And the guy's going, "What book?" Because he had never read all the way through the Bible and had never read Habakkuk. And so I remember reading that tract. And you know what I did before I went to bed that night? I read Habakkuk. But I didn't read Zephaniah or Haggai or Nahum. And so that's why I made it the goal. And I was in high school someplace to read through the Bible all the way through. Catch all the stuff you normally don't catch in a lot of evangelicalism. So what would be really, really good would be to read the Minor Prophets, but to read them with understanding. It doesn't have to be a study Bible, but you know, study Bibles have introductions. Spend some time with some good, you know, the Reformation Study Bible or there's a number of good study Bibles or other things that will give you some background, have some idea. What was the background to Zechariah? What was the background to these are things that are really, really important. And I'm seeing a lot of memes where people are saying, you know, I used to say I'll do it when I get around to it. And now I got lots around to it, so I still don't want to do it. And yeah, that's exactly right. That's the situation. So, you might want to do it. It's from the book of Zechariah, the 14th chapter. So Zechariah is not a short book. It may be a minor prophet, technically speaking. It's not a short book. And it begins in Zechariah 14:6. What? Oh, well, I wasn't planning on doing that, especially in the Old Testament. The text is just too small. But I can do that. But... Now I've got to do this, now that it's up there. It's easier in my eyes, I guess. But anyway, Zechariah 14:6, "In that day there will be no light, the luminaries will dwindle, for it will be a unique day which is known to Yahweh, neither day nor night, but it will come about that at evening time there will be light. And in that day living waters will flood out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and the other half toward the western sea. It will be in summer as well as in winter. And Yahweh," and this was the text. So so the context here seems, there's a lot in Zechariah and Zephaniah that a lot of New Testament scholars see as background imagery and teaching for New Testament books. And clearly, you know, when you have Ezekiel and his vision of the temple, and now here, the living waters going out of Jerusalem, yeah, these are themes that are picked up a lot in the New Testament and expanded upon there. So there's the background. The living waters will flow out of Jerusalem. Jesus describes himself, living waters flowing up within the person. Clearly, there are fulfillment themes and connections there. But it's verse 9 that was in focus. "And Yahweh will be king over all the earth. In that day, Yahweh will be the only one, and his name the only one." Now, what was interesting is, you know, I saw Andrew post that, and I looked at the text, and, you know, the first thing attached to their mind, Yahweh will be king over all the earth. And so you have all the Old Testament the prophecy concepts of the knowledge of Yahweh filling the earth and all the rest of this. And a lot of eschatological perspectives put that all off into a far, far distant future. So that I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of evangelicals don't resonate with what's in the Minor Prophets is because, well, that's all in the millennium someplace. So I, you know, don't really have to worry about it. It's not something that it's not really something I have to think about. But Yahweh will be king over all the earth. And again, I need to mention this. I apologize. If you're reading the English and you see Lord, you're probably going, well, why do you say Yahweh? Well, it is interesting. Concordance does this for me here. Notice what it's doing. Since each of these are tagged, then you can see, well, I'll just do it this way so you can actually see it. In the English, Lord is in all capitals, but the O and the R and the D are in smaller font size. I know that the vast majority of the audience knows this. Don't feel badly if you don't, but you do need to know it. And you're blessed to have it in your English translations. I'll tell you why in a moment. That is the English Bible translator's way of telling you that the underlying Hebrew term is right here. And that is Yahweh, which we slaughter in English as Jehovah. Now, if you read Hebrew, you know that that actually has three vowels underneath it, which are the vowels for Adonai. They're put there to warn you, don't pronounce this word. Because in a Jewish synagogue, for example, you would create great offense if you were to say Yahweh LeMelech, the king, will be king. You're to say Hashem, the name, or Adonai, and you put the vowels there to tell you you're supposed to say Adonai. But it's Yahweh. And you can see over in the Greek Septuagint on the right-hand side that it's Kurios, the Greek term for Lord, which then becomes so important in the New Testament. And so Yahweh will be king over all the earth in that day. Now, let's go ahead and look at the Hebrew since we've got it up here. Let me blow it up just a little bit more so it's really nice and big here. And make sure we've got only 4:9 up here. Okay, all right. So your standard verb to be, estai in Greek, here in the Hebrew, haya, and Yahweh, performative king, melech. You've heard of molech, that's king, as a form of king, and Yahweh will be king over all ha'eretz, the earth, same term used in Genesis 1. And Yahweh will be king over all the earth, bayom, yom day, same again as Genesis 1, there are connections here, in, preformative bet, in that day, that specific day, Yahweh Echad. Now you may have heard that term before, Echad. You see over in the Greek Septuagint, it's Heis. Heis Miahen is one, the ordinal one. And so you can see in the Greek, ente hemera ekaine esse kurias heis, in that day he will be the one Lord, or the one Yahweh. And Akkad, of course, is the equivalent to when we talk about the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Yahweh Eloheinu, Yahweh Echad. And so you have the same term being used here, that is in the Shema from Deuteronomy 6, which is the identifying prayer of the monotheistic Jew. Yahweh will be one. And of course, that I just mentioned in passing, don't want to be losing everybody here, but if you're taking notes, you will notice that in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, these same terms appear when Paul gives that, what looks like an early creedal formulation from the early church, where he takes the Shema and he expands it out to include Jesus as Yahweh, as Kurios. There's one Kurios. Heis, Kurios, both are used there in 1 Corinthians 8, as well as in the Septuagint translation of the Shema. So, in that day, Yahweh will be Echad, the one. And then literally, in the Septuagint says, Kaita anima autu hen, and his name one. Now, if you're wondering, and we do have people, no, I do not want to download my updates right now. Thank you very much. And we do have people that, in this audience, that will catch stuff like this. You'll notice over here, we have Heis, and I said that meant one. And then it says his name, the only one, is Hen. And sometimes that throws people off. Is this a different word? Does it mean a different thing? And yet, look at the Hebrew, look at the middle column when I move between the two. You'll notice that the word that it moves between is the same, Echad. It's Heis, Mia. Heis is the masculine, Mia the feminine, Hen is the neuter, which goes with Ta'anima, his name. So it's just simply matching the word that it's modifying there. And so that's why they're both the same. They're just in different forms because name and Kurios is masculine. Name is neuter. So they match. So that's just good Greek. But it says, and the name of him won. And you'll notice, look at that. This is interesting. You notice that, and they did a good job here. I'm impressed. It doesn't always work this well. And I hadn't looked at any of this beforehand, by the way. I had not looked at what the linking would do, and that's just happening live as we go along here. But notice that it has the name, and you'll notice it marks four words in the Greek Septuagint. And the name of him, and his name. So if it was really consistent over on the English, it would be his name is marked here, but it's probably just going with the Hebrew as the primary linking text here, as the original text. But in Hebrew, you only have two words. His name, Echad, one. And so we have to fill in the meaning or provide other words. And so you'll see in some translations there will be italics used to indicate the added words or something like that. Because in English we just don't say, and his name won. And in that day, he will be Yahweh won, Kurios Heis, and his name won, Ta'anima Atu Hen. Takes more words in Greek and in English to render the underlying Hebrew, but that's what you have here. And so, what does all that mean? It is seemingly an assertion. I think probably what caught Andrew's attention initially. Was the assertion that Yahweh will be king over all the earth. There will be a recognition of his rulership. And all forms of eschatology affirm that. It's when and how it happens that is different. But all forms of eschatology have to recognize that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. That is a reality of what we are saying. And because that is a reality of what we are saying, I guess you couldn't have heard that. How'd you hear that? Oh. Because I... Oh, I... Okay, I turned the sound off, so maybe I won't hear it again. Anyway, so that alone would be enough to really give consideration to, that it is God's intention that he be known over all the earth, and not simply in the form of rebellion, but in subjugation. Because it's one thing to the Lord will be king over all the earth. What does that mean? It's one thing to say his name will be proclaimed over all the earth. It's another thing that he will function as king over all the earth. Whatever you do with your eschatology, there has to be a fulfillment where Yahweh will be king over all the earth. And in that day, Yahweh Echad. And it's really hard for me to not think that this phrase right here, and I really, honestly, I've been trying to find the color thing. If any of you who work for Accordance listen to the Dividing Line, help me find the color thing. But Yahweh Echad, that's the end of the Shema. So think about what's being really said here. In that day, Yahweh Echad, the very ending of the Shema that identified all the Jewish people, their confession will be known over all the earth. There will be no more false gods. There will be no more competitors. Yahweh Echad, only the one true God. No more apologetics. Thanks be. Thanks be. I am not one of those people that goes, that'd be a bummer because then I wouldn't get to argue with people anymore. No, not in, that would be wonderful. Yahweh Echad. Yahweh will be the only one. And his name, Echad. So no other names. No other competitors. He will be known. You know, the question really is, do we believe this? And like I said, different eschatologies fit the fulfillment of this in at different times. We get to there with different intervening events, judgments, resurrections, all sorts of things. But it has to be a central aspect of any eschatological position that this is going to take place, that this is a reality. And given that you have fulfilled prophecies in these minor prophets, Zechariah, Zephaniah, and things like that, we have every confidence, we have every reason to be confident that the God who brought those prophecies to fulfillment in ancient times, even though hundreds of years later, can continue to do so down to our day as well. And it certainly should be something that we desire, that Yahweh's name, that he will be king over all the earth. And how do we know? You know, what's the fulfillment of this? Who is King of Kings and Lord of Lords? Well, it's Jesus. It's Jesus. And so we have fulfillment in the New Testament of these things as well. So it's a beautiful text. If you're looking at memorizing some texts in your downtime, this would be certainly an uplifting one to be memorizing at this particular point in time. As we face the difficult days ahead. So I wanted to look at that and talk with you about that. Now, I have been putting off, and I still, especially in regards to a lot of the specifics, but I do want to spend a little time, because I've been looking at it's just been building up. Kenneth Wilson is a medical doctor. He practices medicine as a board-certified orthopedic hand surgeon in the United States. And he holds a doctorate from the University of Oxford in philosophy. And evidently, this book is the popularized form of his dissertation. You don't see any markings in this because I've been doing the markings in Kindle. I must seek to be as gracious as I possibly can be. I am, however, stunned that this work was granted anything at Oxford at all. We have very, 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 very different historiographies. We have a very, very, very different approach to church history, what you can and cannot know in church history, and how to do church history. So that's going to come out very, very clearly as we look at this. What you need, the reason that you might be interested in this book is that it is being used by the provisionists. In fact, the book makes reference to both David Allen and Leighton Flowers. So to give you an idea of where it's coming from, the author is zealously committed to a full-on, pretty much Pelagian view of free will. And he has a tremendous commitment to finding in history that which will substantiate his thesis. He is horrifically unguarded in his language. I went into the book expecting what you read when you read dissertations. I'm having to read a lot of dissertations right now because of the work that I'm doing in a different field. But there are certain things you avoid when doing a dissertation. You are supposed to be following the research. And so you're guarded in your language, in the analysis, in the research analysis, and all the way up to the conclusions, because your final argument has to be based upon a fair and impartial analysis of what's come before. There's none of that in this. None. Beginning to end, it is a diatribe. It is specifically, there is no possibility the other side has any merit whatsoever. And therefore, the language is used is incredibly unguarded. What was extremely strange is the anachronism from beginning to end of this book. What the book does is it takes Reformed theology, ignores any development from Calvin on, just sort of, it's just whatever Calvin is, and reads the modern context of theological disputes and everything else back into the early church. Now, that's not uncommon in unscholarly work. That's what you expect. That's what you got from Dave Hunt. Okay. That's what Dave Hunt was all about. Dave Hunt was all about, anachronistically transporting our issues today back into the early church. And so he turned Augustine into the first Roman Catholic. Not realizing that, and not caring that his definition of Roman Catholic today, anyone in Augustine's day wouldn't have even had a clue what in the world he was talking about. It carries so much weight, development, and everything else that. And so when you do historical research, you have to be very, very careful about that. You have to be incredibly concerned about taking language that we use today and finding a parallel in the early church and not realizing there's been so much development in between that to just simply say, ah, this person said this, this person, therefore, same thing. There is a lot of that kind of simplistic error throughout this book. It just shocked me. I went into this with high expectations. And that's why almost every page in Kindle is got color all over it. Can you believe this? What? Did you? What? It, almost every page. It's amazing. It really, really is. But just to give you an idea, I mean, I could have started. I think once before I actually read some of the introduction to give you an idea. But let me in the conclusion, inspecting the foundation of Augustinian Calvinism. Now, the assumption of the book is that Augustine and Calvin are, that Calvin slavishly followed Augustine. And there are a couple of quotes he gives from Calvin that out of context sounds like that's what Calvin's saying. In context, they don't. That's what's taken this so long is that, you know, there's a lot of resources cited. You have to track them all down. And especially right now, that's not always easy to do. A lot of, like, libraries are closed and stuff like that. But I've tracked a lot of them down, and I've, again, been stunned. If I have overseen other people's work in various seminaries, I don't know how this got past anybody. I really don't. Somebody was asleep at the switch. Augustinian Calvinists claim the only person to correctly interpret the Apostle Paul's deterministic scriptures for the first four centuries was Augustine. But, of course, they omit the Stoics, Gnostics, and Manichaeans who previously interpreted these texts as teaching unilateral determinism. Now, one of the challenges here is that the vast majority of even our audience, and I'd say that to say that our audience is an unusually well-read audience, really is. But even the vast majority of our audience probably has next to no knowledge of Manichaeanism at all. Right, Rich? I mean, you've lectured on Manichaeanism, right?
Manichaeism. I've seen those in the grocery, in the department stores. Mannequins. Is that?
That's pretty much where most of us are. I looked at the notes from my seminary, and remember, my church history class was awesome. Classes were awesome. My church history professor was awesome, but church history in a general seminary course is an elective. Sometimes it's required. Hopefully, should has always been in the past, but isn't so much anymore. Can sometimes be done in a Jan term class. And Manichaeanism was not discussed to any deep length. I mean, I knew who Manny was. My notes did say that he was, you know, born in the early third century, you know, so flourished in that time period. Gnostic influences, Eastern influences, that was about it. That was about it. So, by the way, if you're really interested in a quick up to speed on it, I was really impressed. This isn't always the place to go, but somebody did their homework, or some group of people did their homework. The article on Manichaeanism on Wikipedia is big and lots of references and not half bad at all. I mean, for Wikipedia, I was impressed. Really was. I mean, nice graphics and when you study it, because, you know, as he mentioned here, he said, but of course they omit the Stoics, Gnostics, and Manichaeans who previously interpreted these texts as teaching unilateral determinism. So, first of all, anyone who knows anything about Stoics, Gnostics, and Manichaeanism knows that there are differences between each one of these. Manichaeism is a form of Gnosticism, but with an incredibly wide variety of influences that Mani brought into his self-made religion in the middle of the 3rd century. So in other words, around 250-ish. And he brought in stuff from Zoroastrianism and Buddhism and Gnosticism and Christianity, and it is a massive mishmash. There's all sorts of different Jesuses, and it's just a mishmash of messy, messy stuff. And it does not even begin to share any foundational worldview similarity to anything that could be identified as Christianity. You don't have a single creator God. You do not have anything like that. And so any kind of, for example, the Gnostics, let's take a step back. The Gnostics precede Mani, even though there's continuing development in various forms of Gnosticism during Mani's life as well. But Gnosticism really begins flourishing about 100 years before Manichaeism does. And exists in its primitive forms even during the New Testament period, though the final forms that it... Well, there weren't any final forms of Gnosticism, let's put it that way. There are final forms as far as this, as far as it developed in a certain area, something like that. But the Gnostic worldview is a dualistic worldview. But it to say that it has a singular personal creator... Yahweh was an evil god in Gnosticism. Well, once Gnosticism encounters Judaism and Christianity and makes room for it, Yahweh becomes identified as an evil god because he created the earth. And since it's dualistic, if it's physical, it's evil. Therefore, Yahweh is a demiurge, an evil deity, powerful, but evil. And so there is a divine spark in each person coming from the one divine source, and that ends up in Manichaeism as well as Gnosticism. But how you access that, exactly what that means, depends on how it's fleshed out in the various Gnostic groups, and Mani even changes his own view over time on that. The point is this: none of them are based upon a monotheistic worldview. None of them are based upon the prophets and apostles. None of them are based upon grammatical historical interpretation of New Testament texts. None of that matters to Ken Wilson. As long as you can draw a parallel, as long as the Gnostics, because see, the mystery religions, one aspect of certain of the mystery religions, notice how I try to always leave open the reality that there were many manifestations of these religions and many differing ways, and there is no one Gnosticism. There is no one Manichaeism, because even Mani changed his own beliefs over his own lifetime. Some people ran with one thing, some people ran with another thing. That's how you have to talk about these things, because you know that there are differing interpretations of even the documents that are available to us today from the Nag Hammadi Library or whatever else it might be. As to the different kinds of Gnosticism and the different aspects of Manichaeism and all the rest of that kind of stuff. So you'll notice that as I say this, I'm not saying Gnostics believe this. It was a form of Gnosticism that believed something like this. And in the mystery religions, many of them believed that by going through their various religious ceremonies, you would receive gnosis, knowledge, that would allow you to free yourself from the trappings of this physical body. The real you is that divine spark that longs to be reunited to the great divine spark, but that can't happen as long as you're attached to the flesh. Now, was that a regular theme in most dualistic and Gnostic? Yes. Were there exceptions? Of course. You have to recognize those things. So those who partook in the mysteries might be called the chosen ones because they have received this special knowledge. And so what you do, what Ken Wilson does, is you just draw a nice straight line, get out a ruler, go, boom, elect in Calvin, boom, elect amongst the Manichaeans and Gnostics. So, I do want to get into this, especially this one later on. There's a discussion of Basilides and gift of faith. Completely different context, but he brings it up a number of times because it's one of his killer verses. I want to get into those. I want to read all the contexts. I have them in the early church fathers, Sarus Lingua Graeca, things like that. And just show you how this is being done and how those who work in the field go, huh? But if you don't have access to this kind of stuff, and I don't remember when it was, 1995 or I forget when we got the TLGC to ROM, but we could barely afford it back then. Yeah, turn all those things back in, but had it for years, had it for a long, long time. We were one of the first people that had it. Yeah, for doing my when I did my THC, we got that for me, and it was extremely, extremely useful. But if you look up these sources, then you go, whoa, wait a minute. But see, a lot of people just can't look up these sources, and so you go, must be what it is. So the point is, going back to what I started reading, you can tell I'm not going to get very far with it. Background is the whole point here. Having the background in church history is the whole point here. Augustinian Calvinists claim the only person to correctly interpret the Apostle Paul's deterministic scriptures for the first four centuries is Augustine. No, we don't. No, we don't. Calvin didn't say that, Augustine didn't say that. You're assuming that some of the assumptions here, and it's all through the book. Maybe in his dissertation he dealt with this, but he forgot it in here. We don't have a tremendous amount of the early church's writings. For many of the earliest fathers, what we have is because somebody quotes them partially at a later point in time. If we didn't have Eusebius's church history, we wouldn't even know some of these people existed. But the reality is we have only a small portion of the extant literature. And so one of the first things that caught me when I first started looking through this was how many times it was the universal view. The only fair way of actually saying that is in the extant literature that we have that specifically addresses this issue, it seems that the predominant view prior to would be this, and then Augustine changed it. That's fair. This has no desire to be fair. It doesn't even try to be fair. It is completely imbalanced, horrifically so, just way out there. That's what I was just like, what's going on here? So I would argue the Epistle of Dionysius, we call it Mathetes, and Mathetes means a disciple, is this guy who wrote to Dionysius. There's good evidence, fragmentary. Seems to me that he has the same view of the elect. Clement of Rome talks about the elect all the time. Are you telling me Clement of Rome was a proto-Gnostic? No, I don't think so. His doctrine seems to go along those same lines. But these are not the primary topics that the early church writers were addressing either. They had other topics that they were addressing, other things that they were focused upon, primarily theological and Christological issues. As I've pointed out, I don't know how many times in this program, it takes to the fourth century before we have a full-length treatise on the atonement. And there aren't too many people alive today that would actually agree with everything even that said in light of all the different theories of the atonement that you can parse out of Tertullian and Irenaeus and the recapitulation theory and all the, all this type of stuff. So making the first centuries the theological standard. That's the other thing. It's like, yeah, I'm used to the fact that the Roman Catholics do that. You're not a Roman Catholic, so I'm not sure where in the world you're going on this. But that type of thing happens. So Augustinian Calvinists claim that Augustine, in his dispute with Pelagius, provided important and insightful interpretations of key soteriological texts that have been demonstrated to be consistently true based upon the hermeneutics of the grammatical historical interpretation of the original languages of Scripture, even though Augustine had limited access to the original languages of Scripture. And when he was in error, it was primarily due to his reliance upon the Latin Vulgate. Well, not the Vulgate, but the Latin. The Vulgate is translated during his lifetime by Jerome, but the Latin tradition. See, that's a completely different statement. And that kind of careful, accurate statement that takes in consideration a wide amount of information is never found in here. There just aren't any of them there. Everything in here is just pedal to the metal, full, I have a thesis, and I'm going to cram it into history, and I'm going to put it out there, and that's just all there is to it. So, well, as far as its abuse of history, yes. Yeah, very much so. So when he argues that the Stoics, Gnostics, and Manichaeans had previously interpreted this text as teaching unilateral determinism, what they meant, what Augustine meant, are two different things. And to confuse them just means you are a very, 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 very theologically confused person. Two different things. Two different contexts, two different meanings. And then to assume that there is a straight line that just simply goes Augustine, Calvin, and Calvin's just sitting there going, whatever you say. That's not what he did. You can pretend that. I know the quote. Go ahead. You guys repeat the, I read it. You go ahead and repeat the quote. I'll take it apart when I get to it. Just be ready. Already looked it up. Yeah, I know when that Calvin said he could write his confession of faith out of what Augustine said. Look at the first few pages before that little context thing. How many of you, I wonder, in that group, they're just going, oh, I know. How many of you read the pages before that? How many of you looked it up? How many of you found it online? How many of you did your homework? That's the question. I continue. Somehow, Calvinists purport only Augustine, baptized in highly deterministic Stoicism, Neoplatonism, and Gnostic Manichaeism, got it right. In their view, every one of over 50 early church fathers got it wrong on human freedom of choice. Again, I stop. Again. So what's he assuming? That he knows even though there are not 50 early church fathers that wrote a book on the subject, he is assuming, based upon what fragmentary material we have left, that he can come up with a universal perspective. So from fragmentary stuff, and many of these early church fathers did not address this in the fragments we have. How do you know what they believed? You don't know that. You don't know that. Please. This is not how you do, this is not how you respect church history. This is not how you do church history. Astonishing. Anyway, in their view, even Augustine himself admitted that he had tried but failed to continue in the essential and unanimous Christian doctrine of free will throughout the first four centuries. What Wilson will do is he will use this kind of language. He will make an argument through use of language without ever substantiating it. Just the language itself becomes the argument. So then he at least provides the quote. What Augustine said? Did Augustine identify unanimous Christian doctrine of free will throughout the first four centuries? Here's the quote. In the solution of this question, I struggled in behalf of free choice of the will, but the grace of God won out. That's the quote. And now, how is this relevant to today? I have said over and over again that provisionists are not only anti-Reformed theology, they're anti-Reformation. They are on Rome's side. In the nature of the will, they are not just in the Tiber River. They have put their rope around the dock over on the other side of the Tiber River. Listen to this. The famous Reformed theologian Benjamin Warfield commented, and I'm appreciative of the fact that it's a direct quote. A lot of folks know this quote. I memorized it decades ago. They know the quote, but they don't always quote it accurately. The Reformation, inwardly considered, was just the ultimate triumph of Augustine's doctrine of grace, it actually continues, over Augustine's doctrine of the church. I don't know why that part wasn't quoted. And then notice the statement. Warfield's statement is pinpoint accurate. Remember a few weeks ago when I explained why this was? When I first started looking at this book, I spent the time to talk about why did Augustine contradict himself? Why could Augustine be used by both Roman Catholics and Protestants during the course of the battles of the Reformation, especially in the 16th century? And I pointed out that Augustine is a tremendous example to us of how the battles of your life determine what you see and what you don't see. And the two great battles that Augustine fought, first part of his ministry, the Donatist controversy, a schism and a division in the church, a schism over the concept of the sacraments, ex opera operato, ex opera operanti, the Donatist ex opera operanti, that the state of grace, the spiritual purity of the person performing the sacrament determined the sacrament's efficacy. Therefore, they didn't follow the Catholic chain of succession in the bishopric because they alleged that one of the people involved in the setting apart of a particular bishop was an apostate, a traitor, a traditor, had given up the scriptures under the Roman persecution. So Augustine develops ex opera operato. It is by the functioning of the sacrament, not the person performing it, which remains Roman Catholic theology to this day. That remains Roman Catholic theology to this day. And that was part and parcel of that. That's what defined the beginning of Augustine's ministry. And so that's what he's focused upon. The end of his ministry is focused upon his struggles with Pelagius and all the related political struggles. Remember the Battle of Zosimus and the North African bishops standing firm against Pelagius, even when the Pope in Rome is sort of going, well, I'm not sure Pelagius is all that bad. And then the North African bishops are saying, yes, he is. And that's where the Rome has spoken, the case is closed error came from. Remember that? Came up in the debate with Piers Travinskis. Oh, my goodness. You know what? 20-year anniversary for the Stravinskis debate next year. We got to do something about that. We're old. are you just telling me we're not going to remember it next year? It's going to get right on by. Yeah, we need to look up the date of when that was because I can guarantee you, to this very day, Peter Stravinskis really, really, really dislikes me. Look it up in your gizmo. That's right. May 24th, 2001. We need to put that on the calendar. Sometime the week before that, we need to have a Peter Stravinskis Memorial Day for that particular one. Anyway, the Warfield statement is exactly correct. This is why there was a contradiction in Augustine. That's what Warfield is saying, is Warfield's doctrine of the church and Warfield's doctrine of grace are contradictory to one another because of the two great battles that he fought. Augustine, what did I say? Oh, I said Warfield is right that Augustine's doctrine of the church is different than his doctrine of grace. And so notice what Wilson then says. Warfield's statement is pinpoint accurate, but unfortunately, due to Luther's and Calvin's reliance upon Augustine, the unmerited grace of the Christian God did not triumph. In Augustinian Calvinism, parenthesis reformed, parenthesis closed, theology, it was the radicalized grace of the Manichaean God that triumphed. So the Reformation had a different God. That's Ken Wilson's, that's not Ken Wilson's conclusion based upon his studies. That's where he started. And that is plainly seen here. Plainly seen here. I don't know how any dissertation advisor, any Dr. Vodder, did not see that, because it's so obvious. It's so plain. And it has to be challenged right from the start. So, here what's being said. The Reformation proclaimed a Gnostic God. That's Ken Wilson's conclusion. Now, we'll discover he failed horrifically to substantiate that. And the forms of argumentation are stunning, stunningly bad, but that's what's being said. Augustine was the father of Tulip. Now, I've had so many non-Reformed people argue that not even Calvin believed Tulip in the fullest sense. Tulip is obviously us looking back and formulating Calvin's theology, or at least the theology of the next generation. But Augustine was the father of Tulip. Total depravity, total inability to respond to God. That's not what Augustine said, and that's not what Calvinism says. And if you don't know that, then you're not even listening. You're not even doing the first bit of attempting to honestly deal with this issue. That's not what we believe. Total inability to respond positively in repentance and faith to God? Yes. But all mankind responds to God in many different ways. One of the most famous statements that Calvin ever made is a meme that is all over Facebook and Twitter. What do you say? What do you say about the human heart? The human heart is a constant factory of idols. It's a constant factory of idols. And he was right. But what does that mean? That means the heart responds to God in rebellion, in the creation of idols. Total depravity does not mean an inability to respond to God. It means man responds to God within the capacity that his fallen nature limits him to. So there was never the slightest attempt. And look, been doing this a few years, folks. I have encountered over my years many people in this spectrum of view that simply will not accurately represent Reformed theology because they detest it with a visceral detestation. And I think in their mind, to even think about accurately representing it is an act of compromise. And I think that's what we've got here. Unconditional election, Stoic, Gnostic, Manichaean, and then he came up with this DUPIED, D-U-P-I-E-D, as an acronym for unconditional predestination of individuals to eternal damnation. Limited atonement, Christ died only for the elect. Irresistible grace, ready for what that means? Violent Manichaean grace. Yeah, that's what regeneration means. Violent Manichaean grace. And the gift of perseverance, invented by Augustine to explain the extreme differences in how persons live their lives following salvific infant baptism. Now, the Dr. Wilson's understanding of the incredibly complex field of baptism in the early church is astonishingly shallow. astonishingly shallow. I mean, when I was listening to him talking about Augustine trying to come up with an understanding of how to believe in the elect, but still go with the preceding traditions that were his, and I was like, really? Wow. Yow! Just really, really bad. Interesting discussion, but think about it. What you're actually being told. Think of all the sermons you've heard out of John chapter 6, John chapter 10, John chapter 17, Philippians chapter 1, Ephesians chapter 2, on the subject of the perseverance of the saints. Had nothing to do with what any of those texts said. It was all because of Manny. The guy who made a mishmash of Buddhism, Zoroastrianism, Gnosticism, Judaism, and Christianity. Yeah, that's where it actually came from. No one has ever exegeted these texts, honestly. All the decades that I've spent going through this explanation and that explanation of John 6, in my debate with Layton, I wasn't standing there reading Romans 9, translating it and exegeting it. No, I wasn't doing that. I had Manny's notes in front of me. That's what it was. Y'all need to know that, that's all that. So, we just mindlessly follow what somebody else said, what Manny said, even though most of us have never read a single word that Manny ever said. But we still, now I'm not saying, don't hear me wrong. All of us, our traditions have been impacted by those who've come before us. But this kind of simplistic straight line stuff is simply absurd. I mean, any serious historian knows that after Augustine, even as soon as Gottschalk, you already have development. There's already a change in context. So no matter what, by the time you get post-Renaissance and you put Augustine's interpretations into the context of post-Erasmian, New Testament's available, Old Testament's available, Latin is being rejected as the primary source, you're now dealing with that that makes a straight line laughably silly and simplistic and erroneous. That's why nobody believes it. No one should believe it. Therefore, modern Calvinism in these deterministic distinctives has more in common with ancient philosophies and religious heresies than with early Christianity. An objective evaluation of the facts cannot avoid this startling conclusion. Here's my assertion. That's the conclusion that Dr. Wilson started with, and not shockingly, therefore, ended with. As we will see, as we have time, in the midst of lots of important other stuff, to document this kind of stuff, to dig into the citations. This is what happens when you have a monomaniacal focus. I have a thesis, and that thesis is man's free will must be defended. And therefore, I'm going to find a way to do it. And we have encountered so many different ways in which that has been done down through the years. So many different ways. This is a more recent way. Through, unfortunately, the utilization of historical documents and resources that most people simply don't have sitting in the library or don't know necessarily how to find in some of the resources where you can find them. I mean, CCEL has some of these things. Some of the books and articles are available, but many of them are not available unless you have access to a research library. And so checking all the sources can be somewhat difficult. But we will definitely be looking at some of these and going, you see, the source actually didn't say that. Now, I know what someone's going to say. You just need to read the dissertation. Look, I've looked at, what was it, $95 or something like that? Here's my thesis. If you can't take your dissertation and summarize it accurately in a book of that length, you shouldn't have written it in the first place. Shouldn't have written in the first place. So if this ain't accurate, if this ain't good enough, I'm not faulting it. I'm not faulting it for what it doesn't contain. I'm faulting it for what it does. For the citations it actually does provide. That's the issue there. Real quickly here. Yeah, I'm going to just read you one more. This is from the conclusion. This is the next paragraph. Because current Calvinist deterministic interpretations of scripture passages are interpretations brought into Christianity through Augustine's Manichaean past. Excuse me. I read Romans 8 and 9 in Greek long before I ever had any idea of any connection between Manny and Augustine at all. So, did you even try to demonstrate? I don't get the feeling that Dr. Wilson can engage these texts. I really don't. I could be wrong. I just did not get that feeling. So to say that you can bring entire interpretations, are you seriously saying that, well, Dr. Allen was quoting from what primary commentaries on Romans when we responded to him? Douglas Moo, a little bit from Murray, and Tom Schreiner. Are you saying that Moo and Schreiner are devotees of Manny? Can you prove that their exegetical methodology is based upon the worldview of Manichaeism? If you can't, then you've failed in your thesis. And that is a fundamental refutation of your position. If any meaningful interpretation of these texts yields the conclusions that we have presented, and that your side has been noticeably conspicuous for badly not being able to defend against, then that statement is absurd. Calvinism leans upon Manichaean interpretations of key scriptures. That is an absurdity. I'll quote it again. Calvinism leans upon Manichaean interpretations of key scriptures. I'll say it again. Absurdity. Calvinism lacks a solid historical and biblical foundation within early Christianity. It rests upon unstable sand of ancient heretical and pagan doctrines. For these reasons, the tiny foundation upholding the impressively logical structure of Augustinian Calvinism should be pronounced unstable and condemned as unsafe. Can you see why I was expecting, oh, we've got a Oxford dissertation. That means it will have these commitments to scholarship, language, care, balance, none of that. Now, maybe that was all it was in the dissertation. Got all sucked out before it got in here. Because it's not in there. It's not in there anyway. Yes, sir.
Okay, a couple of things, because I started getting phone calls on this a while back.
I don't know what your point is.
You need to hear me.
Well, I can hear you.
So the first thing that I want to point out here is...
During the show today?
What's that?
You're getting calls during the show today?
No. I've gotten calls about this book months ago when Dr. Flowers started having...
Well, you had him on a show. That's
yes. And my initial... you've confirmed my initial response is, so he's essentially taking what the Roman Catholics have done about owning Augustine, okay, and there have been this, what is it, post and pre-retractiones?
Oh, yeah. The retractiones
we're going to corner out and slice out a whole new corner of the world for our view of Augustine, even though the Roman Catholics have misrepresented him. And
well, the Roman Catholics didn't have to misrepresent him.
Right.
That was my point.
Well, and that's my point. I meant to say it that way. But just to give you an idea here as to how early church history gets abused, and the Roman Catholics, I've seen you in debate, show this repeatedly. But the one debate I want to point people to, if you don't think that it's fair that James just went through and showed citations being miscited.
Well, I haven't even started that.
Okay.
I'm making the allegation, but we're going to document that to the nth degree.
The debate, it's on Sermon Audio, is the Bible the only infallible rule of faith, with Tim Staples. It was, where's the date on this? July 23rd, 1996. There is an episode in there during the cross-examination, folks, that really illustrates.
Is that one in Fullerton?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, both of those with Tim were in Fullerton. Same place, same hall.
Yeah.
And there is an exchange there where Tim has been citing and citing and citing, and James keeps calling these out, and he starts reading the fuller context, reading the fuller context, reading the fuller context. Well, I think it was TLG.
Mm-hmm. Thesaurus Lingua Graeca.
CD-ROM that was sitting on your computer that enabled you to be able to look up the fuller context of those quotes, and then you called him out, and you said, do you actually have the quotes, or are you reading from a quote book, Juergens?
Juergens.
And this is what happens. So,
I understand that for Tim Staples.
Right.
This guy read all of Augustine in Latin. He's got no excuse.
Yeah. So he should know
what I'm saying is, if you this is the danger. If you go into a program of study with your and you want to prove something, you'll prove it.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's not what a dissertation is supposed to be.
And as this was described to me by the phone callers, I immediately went, you know, it sounds to me, didn't know, didn't read the book.
Right.
But it sounds to me like the title's already been written, and now we just need to write the story to go underneath it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, here we are going down that road. Now, the other thing, because I got a phone call about this morning. The guy wanted to know, are you going to actually address this today? And so...
This today?
Yes.
Oh.
And so I'm like, hey, you get to it when he gets to it. There's a lot going on right now.
Just slightly.
And so the other thing, though, is the person that he's talking with is a big defender of Dr. Wilson. Okay? Big defender of Dr. Staples. Flowers. Okay.
So theologically,
I'm having these anyway. There is a name that you used at the beginning of this program, and this fellow that he's exchanging with really objects to the fact that you're name calling. And I asked the gentleman, I said, let me ask you this.
What name?
Hang on, I'll get to it. If we were to refer to someone as a Thomist,
mm-hmm.
would that offend them? Should that offend them if they are actually
if you called me one, I'd be offended.
A devotee of Thomas Aquinas?
Yeah.
But you see, the word means something.
Yeah.
It describes a worldview, a point of view.
Right.
Okay? A certain aspect of study.
Mm-hmm.
It is not a bad word.
No.
It describes something. Mm-hmm. And we have a situation where we are living in a society where words don't really matter by meaning anymore. Instead, it's, well, how dare you that insult me like that, or how dare you this, that, and the other thing. If you're going to argue from a Pelagian perspective, mm-hmm. you need to expect to be called someone who's arguing from a Pelagian perspective. And this fellow that he's encountering is objecting to the fact that you're calling them Pelagians. But yet, my point to them is, just like if I were to call someone a Thomist, that means something. If I call you a Pelagian, I'm not saying that your mother wears combat boots. I am saying that you have a perspective that is Pelagian in nature. So I want you to address that.
Well, I just looked it up because I encountered this in the book. He says, when Rome fell to the Vandals in 410 CE, I wonder why you use CE, Pelagius and Celestius came to Augustine's home of North Africa, present-day Tunisia, instigating the infamous Pelagian controversy. These Pelagian Christians were reportedly teaching doctrines not accepted by other churches. For example, Adam's fall was merely a personal moral failure, so each human born remained in the same state as Adam when Adam was created. There was no traditional Christian original sin, a sin propensity, moral weakness, and mandatory physical death. That's how he's defining original sin here. But the Pelagians had no answer as to why infants were being baptized. Jerome, Augustine, and numerous other Christian leaders attacked these views so fiercely that the Pelagians were eventually excommunicated as heretics. Yet there remains doubt as to whether Pelagius himself actually taught what was attributed to him. In fact, the pejorative term Pelagian became the favorite accusation at that time, a theological death sentence against any person teaching a doctrine another Christian bishop might oppose. So it's interesting that, well, yeah, Pelagius might not have taught those things, you know, and then you've got a reference to that to an author who argues Pelagius did not deserve a heretical status and a few things like that. So, look, the book, you know, the theological content of the book is sparse. To put it kindly, and there's much assumption. So you're going to have the assertion being made that, which I already read, that Calvinist interpretations are Manichaean interpretations, but you don't have that then demonstrated. You don't have a demonstration that Manny actually used grammatical historical interpretation of the scriptures in the original languages. So you're not going to get that type of thing, but the idea that, well, we shouldn't use this term Pelagian, it is a reference to the fact that we now have provisionists who are saying that even what Rome came up with to maintain a semi-Pelagian perspective, which is what? Prevenient grace. The idea that there is this never mentioned in the Bible, but prevenient grace that brings everybody to a moral neutral point so then they can make a free choice. The provisionists are saying that's not needed. That man in and of himself has the capacity without grace. Oh, they say, but the gospel is the grace. But in other words, there is no necessity of a supernatural power. Everybody believes that God had to create the world. So, duh. But the excuse that the provisionists are using is that, well, yes, we're affirming that the gospel comes about by graciousness. God didn't have to give us the gospel. But that you possess the power in and of yourself to embrace that gospel without prevenient grace, without any supernatural grace actually impacting you. That's the issue. That's where the issue lies. And what I've been saying now for about a year is just let them keep going. They're going to get bolder and bolder and clearer the farther they go down this path. As they are pushed, because they're promoting their views, they're putting their stuff out there, as they do that, they're going to be pushed to go farther and farther and farther down this road. All you got to do is compare them 3 years ago to where they are now. And you will see that that's exactly what's going on. That's exactly what's going on. So, anyway, I just want people to understand where this is coming from. As far as the conclusions, the conclusions are also in the introduction. This is not the thesis that the facts demonstrate. This is the thesis that determines what facts Dr. Wilson will look at. And that's not how it's supposed to be done. And I say that as a person who, working on CBGM and the papyri, you know, I'm a little bit stalled right now because my data set could increase by 55% any day. I'm not sure if this current pandemic's slowing that down. But I don't want to come to conclusions when my data set could expand by 55%. So I'm in a little bit of, so I'm just doing side reading and stuff like that. The point is, I am open to where the data is going to take me. I don't have a thesis that I'm trying to find in the data. But I am certainly capable of recognizing when somebody else does. And that's what you have here. That's what you have here. So we will continue that. So you actually got to call this morning about that, huh? Oh, okay. Well, I've mentioned it a few times, but folks, we, you know, there's other stuff going on right now. And I let me do mention, since we, I guess we're going to go to 4:30. My contest in the adherent apologetics bracket has completed. And I made it past Gary Habermas. There are many people very upset about that. If I beat anybody, there are people very, very upset about that. Every single one of those, I don't know if you've noticed all the people, all the little tweets, you know, well, I just can't believe that guy. He's just terrible. He's just horrible.
I'm sorry. I don't know what you're talking about. I have found that Twitter is a highly enlightening and wonderful, fuzzy place to be. It's
very loving.
Yes. It's like... what are those things from there?
Tribbles.
It's Tribbleville.
Tribbles.
It's Tribbleville. It shouldn't be called Twitter. It should be called Tribble.
Oh, the battery died. Either that or this is the one with the bomb in it. I'm not sure which. Only you Trekkies know that one. But,
not so much.
Twitter is still the Tribbles.
It's just a wonderful place where everyone gets along. It's
love and graciousness everywhere.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
But anyway, the point of that is, man, that font is small. Wow. I can't even find it. I'm in a really tough bracket. Really, really tough bracket. So Michael Brown took out Mike Winger.
Yeah, and you've got Bill Craig next.
I've got Bill Craig. I know. I've got Bill Craig next. So, yeah, there it is. James White versus William Lane Craig.
Right.
And so this audience, you know, have you ever seen William Lane Craig with a tribble? You've never seen William Lane. I would bet William Lane Craig doesn't know what a tribble is. That's the horrible part about it all. And doesn't that tell you how you should vote on this? Free tribbles for all if you vote for me. No. Well, if you know anything about tribbles, there was an overpopulation on the Enterprise that got beamed into the engine room of the Klingon ship right before it went to warp, and then on Deep Space Nine. And so there are lots of extra tribbles to be had until the Klingons wiped them out, which is terrible. I'm not sure how we have them now. Well, that's future. Never mind. Yes?
No, I was just going to, as we're wrapping up here, point out, I'm seeing a consistency as you're reviewing these. And if the rest of the audience is, I think they should, that, again, we've got this situation to where the source proof text is not being handled well.
No, it's not.
And we see this with Dr. Allen. We in his treatment of Doctors Mu and
Shriner,
it's we should be better than this.
Oh yeah,
we really should. I've said it a number of times, and I got to a point to where I just couldn't deal with Dr. Flowers as deflecting from it. I've said it repeatedly. You need to sharpen your pencil. If you did this kind of work in business, you wouldn't be in business. You wouldn't.
Well, let's not talk about business right now.
Not right now, no. But the point is, we should be better than this. We should desire the truth, and we should pursue the truth. And we should pursue it as we would pursue excellence. And, you know, I'm...
Well, We got started. We got started. It's going to take, you know, I spent a couple hours one night just on one citation because that's how long it takes to look everything up. And so we'll do that. We will go that direction and we will, help people out. But obviously there's lots of other things to be talking about. I know that's a little bit of an in-depth subject. Just one last thing here. So in my bracket, I cannot read one of them, but, Michael Brown, is going up against somebody. I can't see who it is. It's the font is just like a one. But if I can get past William Lane Craig and Michael gets past whoever it is he's going up against, which I can't see, then it'll be me versus Michael. I think if that happens, then he needs to, well, in that 2-day time period, I need to be on the line of fire and he needs to be on the dividing line. I think we could have some fun with that. But you got to vote if you're going to get us through. And only then I can get into the final four. And, Jeff's down in the bottom over here. Jeff's gotten through too. And I'm trying to find where he is, but man, it is just so small, that I can't find it. But, we could not, wait a minute. Man, I wish that would get big, but it can't. There he is. Yeah. So he's on my side. So we would meet in the final four. We'd be the step before the championship if he made it through his side. But he's up against, Mike Lycona. And I think he's winning 75-25. So, he's got a good shot looking. He's got a much easier bracket than I do. He does. It's a fact. He's got a much easier bracket than I do. But that's okay. So, in fact, did you notice that last competition? Me versus Habermas and Jeff versus Lycona. I have the relationship to Jeff that Habermas has to Lycona. So that was rather interesting. He saw that. So yeah. Yeah. So there's a shot. And I'm not sure who's coming out of the other side. Ravi Zacharias is over there and, Frank Turk is over there. John Lennox is over there. Now Turk's like up against Lennox. So who knows? We'll see. But isn't it strange? This is the only exciting bracket in March in the United States. I mean, the Olympics put off to 2021. Who saw this coming? Well, actually, a lot of people did. Yeah, pretty much. I'm leaving this down here. Because it needs new batteries. Who knew that triples needed AA batteries? I'm not sure if we have any down here anyways, but I'll try to resuscitate the triple because my impersonation's not all that good. So Adherent Apologetics on Twitter. Get on there and help us get past the next round. Oh, there we go. See? Glenn Hendrickson just posted the triples landing on Kirk. Which is one of my favorite scenes in all of Star Trek. It is great. Yeah, see, and Lisa Park. Favorite quotes from the Dividing Line today. Have you ever seen William Lane Craig with a triple? You haven't, have you? Free triples for all if you vote for me. So I've got the geek vote now, but I'm not sure that's going to be enough. So we'll see. I mean, Jeff will help me. You know, we've got to get Apologia Radio folks, and we've got everybody in to get past William Lane Craig. Then it gets really interesting if he gets through at the same time, because then we, you know, if I can get past Michael, then it's me versus Jeff or something. Then it'll get crazy. It'll get absolutely insane. So, anyways, thanks for watching the program today. My plan is to be back tomorrow, so we will be there for you in the midst of your isolation. I'm not planning on doing this tomorrow. So if you're going, oh, please, I've had enough of Manichaeanism for the day. Gotcha. We'll have some other stuff to do, maybe some calls and a few things like that. So we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for watching. God bless.